Okay, we can start. Anyone have any questions before we begin? Nothing? Everything's perfectly clear. Okay. Let me begin by reminding you what we're concerned with in this class. Not just the history, we're concerned with this basic problem of how international conflict is to be understood. And there are various general approaches to this issue that we want to kind of hold up to the light and see what makes sense in the light of the historical evidence. You know, there's the basic liberal view you associate with Woodrow Wilson. You know, most people growing up in a country like this have just kind of absorbed it. You know, it is the idea that most people want peace, that the natural order of things is basically peaceful. So if you have the war, you have a war, it has to be because of perverse human will, because of aggression. You know, wars result from, wars are viewed as kind of a crime. And this is linked to this whole notion that if you want peace, you have to establish a kind of international legal system, which makes it clear what sort of behavior is permissible and what sort of behavior is criminal. And it's also linked to various notions of how you should proceed once you get involved in a war, because if we're involved and we're the good guys, that means the other side must be the aggressors. The other side has to be punished. The other side are lawbreakers. You know, that's a whole cluster of ideas that has enormous power. It's like the whole notion that if you want to understand a particular war, you got to figure out who the aggressor is, plays a very fundamental role in how people approach these particular historical problems of how do you understand the Second World War in Europe? How do you understand the war in the Pacific between the United States and Japan? How do you understand the Cold War? How do you understand the First World War? You know, war for German aggression, whatever. Those notions have a tremendous appeal. They're kind of natural. And it's against that backdrop that an important body of thought grew up that's critical of those notions. This is the thought of, body of thought we call realism, and you've been exposed to one great proponent of realism, George Kennan. He makes a realist critique of U.S. Of the Wilson policy, the policy that took the United States into the war, policy that the United States pursued during the war and at the Paris Peace Conference. And the realist view says, no, you don't really need an aggressor to have war. These moral issues, they're not totally irrelevant, but they don't explain everything by any means. Moral issues are often very fuzzy. They're not clear-cut at all. Because states have to do what they need to do in order to provide for their own security. All right? They have to think not in moral terms of what's right and wrong, but also in political terms, in terms of how is this going to affect the structure of power? How is it going to affect our position in the world? How is it going to affect whether we're vulnerable to foreign pressure? Whether our liberty is at risk? Whether our prosperity is at risk? Countries have to think in terms of interest, in terms of power, in terms of the whole structure, the whole political structure of the system. You know, who's strong, who's weak, How much do we have to worry about these things? What sort of threats do foreign powers pose to us? Not just today, but in the future as well, because no one can see what intentions are going to be in the future with any clarity. So you have to worry about the structure of power. You know, it's like, for example, the United States had to worry about whether, you know, Germany would become the dominant power in Europe during the period of the Second World War, or whether the Soviet Union would dominate all of Europe. Why? It wasn't simply because people viewed Nazi Germany as evil, or the Soviet Union of Stalin as evil. It's like, if those countries were able to amass all of these resources, the vast economic resources of Europe, you know, from the Atlantic to the Urals, under their control, they would be able to use those resources to generate such enormous military power that American security would be threatened. Right? That's a very realist argument. And it has, you know, various nuances to it. It's like saying, well, these other countries in Europe, they might feel like they also have to reach for power for essentially defensive purposes in order to provide for their own security. Maybe the Soviet Union wasn't interested in just spreading revolution, but was worried about threats to its own security from Germany. And so, therefore, felt a need to project its power into Central Europe during the Cold War, to dominate Central Europe, right? So that Soviet policy, based on power considerations, might be eminently understandable. But American resistance to that policy, also equally understandable. You can see things through the eyes of both sides. You don't need to say, one side is evil, the other side is good, one side is the aggressor, the other side is the defender. International politics is not to be reduced to such considerations. Instead, you have kind of a conflict between two sides in which each side is governed by power political considerations. This is these are the standard realist notions. You emphasize the international environment. The range, the freedom of action for a statesman is fairly limited. You know, you're constrained by the structure of the system, by the need to take the structure of power into account. That's the central debate which dominates discussions of international politics. And that debate has a fundamental bearing on how you approach issues of policy. If you're a realist, you're not going to get up on your high horse and say the enemy has to be utterly destroyed. You have a certain sympathy for the enemy's point of view. Doesn't mean you have to give the enemy everything he wants, but it means that you don't think of international politics as a kind of crusade. Your aims are more moderate. You set your sights a bit lower. Your aim is kind of an adjustment. You think in political and not moral terms. Whereas the other view leads to the sorts of policies, you know, we associate with Woodrow Wilson, these Wilsonian policies of promoting freedom around the world, self-determination, without too much regard for how it affects the structure of power in the world. Yeah, is that the way? Those debates are fundamental in this field. So the question for you is, how do you get a handle on these things? How do you figure out who's right and who's wrong? And the whole premise of this course is that there's one method for doing this, and that's by looking at the history through that theoretical lens. Yeah? There are these great conflicts in the 20th century, you know, the First World War, the Second World War in Europe, the Second World War in Asia, the Cold War. Look at these things. What sort of view makes sense? And as an aid to doing that kind of thinking, you want to look at the historical literature dealing with these questions. Yes?
The Kenan article.
Kenan.
Pardon me. Kenan article, I think, substantially agrees with your presentation on conclusions, but substantially disagrees on review of the facts. What are we to make of that as we're kind of sifting through this?
How does it disagree about the facts?
Portrays Clemenceau as sort of vindictive and wants to control Europe. Kind of portrays Wilson as a good guy, but sort of altruistic and moralistic, and not doesn't really deal with the issues of him wanting to punish or be.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah. How do you personally decide whether I'm right or Kenan is right?
Yes. In dealing with midterms, and, you know, there's substantial conflict here. It's not terribly scholarly for us to cite you in a verbal lecture, but that's what my
This is an important issue. How do you go about making up your mind? I mean, I give you a certain line. I'm not going to test you in the midterm on whether you agree with me, right? There are not going to be any essay questions where you're expected to kind of talk about your own interpretation. So for purposes of the exams, that's not an issue. But for your own purposes, in terms of what you want to get out of a course like this, you do need a way of figuring these things out. How do you go about, in principle, figuring out whether, in this area is where Kenan and I disagree, whether Kenan is right or whether I'm right? There's one and only one answer to that. You look at the evidence. There's a massive body of historical evidence that you can go through to reach your conclusions about these matters. I gave you some of this evidence, like those Wilson wartime speeches, for example. You read these speeches. You say to yourself, "Is this guy a champion of a peace of reconciliation? Is his heart really in the right place?" Or, you know, one man's justice is another man's vindictiveness or vengefulness. You know, do you find that in Wilson? Do you find Wilson taking a relatively jaded view of the origins of the war and saying, "Well, you know, it's a mistake to think in terms of Germany being the evil country that caused the war and everyone else being, you know, totally guiltless. That's not the way international politics works by and large. Besides, we don't have enough evidence at this point to decide on these things, and we shouldn't think about the past so much as about the future, and our goal is to create a stable world in the future." Is that what you find when you look at that evidence? It's like, I don't think so. You say, well, maybe there's more to the story than that, and other people make other arguments. Well, you look up if you want and see what other people have said. People take a Wilsonian view. What sort of evidence do they give to support their arguments? Or is this kind of just a projection of their own ideology? Yeah. And so you can get to the bottom of these things. And maybe you don't have the time, the purposes of this course, but you should realize that in principle you can make your mind up for yourself. And in the class I kind of read to you a number of things and talk about, you know, what everyone knows, but you don't actually think of it in these terms. For example, the point that there was no Marshall Plan after World War I the way there was after World War II. Well, right away, that tells you something about what the fundamental American conception was. You know, it's like the goal is not to create a stable world in Europe by helping the Europeans get back on their feet and promoting cooperation among the Europeans. It's like, we defeated Germany. Now we're going to go back home. Well, that tells you something about what the fundamental conception is about how international politics works, the role that America should play in the world, the degree to which the Americans care about political considerations, how you're going to deal with the German threat, and so on. you can draw certain conclusions of your own. Right? But those are fundamental issues, and you should give a certain amount of thought to how you can make your mind up for yourself about these kind of questions. Okay. So our basic method is historical. We look at all this stuff, and we try and reach conclusions. And so in that light, we want to look at the whole problem of the origins of the Second World War. What happened in the interwar period? This period from 1919, when the Treaty of Versailles was signed, to 1939, when a new war broke out. When you look at the historical literature dealing with the interwar period, you're struck by a very dramatic change over time in terms of how people interpret it that corresponds to these debates that I was just alluding to. What is that change? In the immediate post-World War II period, through the 1950s, when people look back on the Second World War and they tried to understand the origins of the Second World War, it was all simple. It's like, war in Europe, well, it was all Hitler. Who could be more aggressive than Hitler? Second World War is a war of German aggression, pure and simple. A war in the Pacific, look how aggressive the Japanese were. Look how awful they were. Look how they attacked the Americans at Pearl Harbor. All very simple. These are wars of aggression. And the Western countries, Britain, France, the United States, they don't want to get involved. They're just the Americans are isolationists. The British especially have this policy of appeasement. Again, this is a moral concept. It's a notion of appeasement with its overtones of kind of moral weakness, cravenness. It's a moral concept. The literature emphasized that sort of thing. For example, Churchill's The Gathering Storm, a very important statement of Churchill's own views about what had caused the Second World War, emphasizes considerations of that sort. And historical analysis that dealt with the origins of the war dealt with the 1930s, with the Nazi period, with the great crises of the late 1930s, the Rhineland crisis in 36, the Austrian crisis in early 38, the Czech crisis in late 38, and then finally the Polish crisis in 1939, right? That was the standard historical interpretation. And then with the passage of time and increasing availability of archival sources, that interpretation shifted. Instead of focusing narrowly on the 1930s, now looked on the whole interwar period as a continuum, 1920s as well as 1930s, and tried to draw out a process unfolding over that entire 20-year period, which had a certain logic to it. The lines between the 20s and the 30s no longer drawn so sharply. But there's continuity here, and what gave it the continuity is the persistence of the central political problem. Right? The political problem, the problem of German power. How are you going to deal with it? Not even the whole question of Versailles. It's like, you could understand why the Germans would want to resist Versailles. But you could also understand why the French would want to enforce it. And in both cases, it's for political reasons, having to do with the structure of power. I'll get to this in a minute. But if you can understand and sympathize with the attitudes of both sides, this whole notion that one side is the aggressor and the other side is the victim, it just doesn't hold up. All right? So historiography shifted. And a lot more attention was paid to the 1920s and to the continuity between the 1920s and 1930s. Okay. What is that political problem that people emphasized? The structural problem. Problem having to do with the structure of power. That term structure, I'm sure you were, those of you who took Poli Sci 20, you were probably exposed to all this stuff. The one of the great international relations theorists of our own day. I just died recently. It's Kenneth Waltz. Kenneth Waltz, his theory is often called structural realism because he emphasizes not the intentions of statesmen and the particular policies that they choose to implement so much as the constraints induced by the structure of the system, by the existence of a certain structure of power and the world around them that they had to contend with. Right? So what's the structural problem? From the French point of view, what's the problem with the possible solutions? The problem is the problem of German power. Germany is inherently a much stronger country than France. You know, like something like 70 million Germans versus 40 million Frenchmen, 60, 70 million, something like that. In terms of industrial power, Germany is more advanced economically than France was, especially in the area of heavy industry, which is the heart of the industrial economies for essentially most of the 20th century. And certainly extremely important in terms of war-making power, given the military technology of that day. Steel production is a crucial index of military potential. Germany is much stronger than France. If you give Germany equal political rights, the right to convert its economic resources into military power is to the same degree that the French could, well, then Germany would once again overwhelm France. Germany would be so much stronger than France. And especially given the changes in the map that had taken place since 1917. The Bolshevik Revolution, the withdrawal of Russia from the international system by and large, the establishment of a wall of independent states between Russia and Germany, going from Finland and the North, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria. All of these, this whole situation favored Germany. The creation of an independent Poland tied to the West favored Germany. Why? Because prior to 1914, the Germans had to worry about Russian power. Now, they didn't have to worry about Russian power. If Russia revived, any Russian threat, well, would be limited because to attack Germany, the Russians would have to move through Poland. But Poland had ties with the West, indeed, with an alliance with France. What that meant was that that would serve as a tripwire, bringing Western power to bear on the Soviet Union and deterring the Soviet Union from not just moving against Poland, but even threatening Germany with attack in principle. Right. So this cushions the Germans. It gives the Germans greater freedom than they had in 1914. They don't have to worry about the Soviet Union as much. As a matter of fact, the existence of this kind of Poland, which included territories that came from pre-war Germany and pre-war Russia, gave Germany and Russia an incentive to join forces with each other, come together. Right? So Germany, in principle, is in a somewhat stronger position if she were free to develop her power. And that would be a source of concern for France. Because if the result of this war that had involved these human sacrifices on this absolutely enormous scale, you know, as I said, 1.3 million Frenchmen died in the war. You know, basically it's the male half of a generation wiped out. You pay this huge blood price, and what is the result of your victory? A Germany that's relatively stronger than she had been in 1914? It's kind of crazy. You don't trust the Germans. You're not willing to go to simply allow them to build up their power to whatever level they feel is appropriate, because your own security is at risk. So what do you need? You need some sort of counterweight to German power. You need stronger power on your side. Ideally, what you would have loved to do is maintain the alliance of the three Western democracies that had come together during the war. You know, America, extremely strong country. You know, if American power backs up France, France doesn't have to worry about Germany no matter what. Even Britain. Britain and France are a match for Germany. But the Americans turn away from Europe after the war. And this is not the result of the defeat of the Treaty of Versailles and the defeat of the League of Nations by the U.S. Senate. It's like it's inherent in the basic Wilson policy to not involve American power in European politics. You know, it's like he does not view America as a normal, integral, natural part of the world power political system. America's on the outside, will kind of preach down to the Europeans and tell them the way they should manage their affairs. But if they don't listen to us, we'll go off in a huff. You know, people say, well, Wilson's an internationalist. He's not an internationalist in the sense of wanting to keep those American troops in Europe. It's not like the first President Bush, George H.W. Bush, saying at the end of the Cold War, the United States is going to stay in Europe. The United States is a European power. That's not the Wilson conception at all. Americans pull out. And the British kind of half pull out. They can't pull out as thoroughly as the Americans do because they have to kind of worry about the continent more than the Americans do. They're not strong enough to kind of just turn their backs on the continent totally. They're much closer to the continent, but they're separate from the continent. I mean, even to this day, Great Britain is an island. They kind of half pull out. And so the ideal French solution, which is the maintenance of union between the three Western democracies, this isn't going to work. And so as a lesser strategy, they have to fall back on the Versailles system. What is the Versailles system? It's a set of constraints designed to keep Germany down, to keep Germany from becoming as powerful as she would become in the absence of those constraints. In the absence of those constraints, Germany would, in effect, overwhelm France, dominate France, because Germany is inherently a stronger country than France. So you need these artificial constraints to keep that from happening. Limits on the size of the German army, on the size of the German navy, no German air force, you know, the Rhineland not to be militarized, you know, all of these constraints designed to prevent Germany from building enough power so that France would have to live in the shadow of German power. Can you blame the French for taking that view, especially since they have no sense for what Germany is going to be like in the future? You know, well, Germany is a democracy now, but this is an artificial democracy. It's an induced democracy. You know, you saw it in those Wilson speeches. Wilson says to the Germans, if you keep your imperial regime, don't expect soft terms from us. You know, implying that, well, if you become a republic, then we'll give you a much more moderate peace. You know, we know this is like for tactical purposes to a certain extent. But it certainly cast a shadow on the Weimar Republic. You know, it's like, well, is this a true revolution that created a true democratic state? Or is this just kind of cosmetic, something they adopted in order to get better terms from the West? And there was no real fundamental shift in the structure of power within Germany. It's still the same old elites that control the army, they control the bureaucracy, they control the judiciary. There hadn't been any true purge. You know, the French were paid a lot of attention to this sort of thing. They were unwilling to say, oh, the Germans are now a democracy. They've fundamentally changed. We don't have to worry about power considerations at all. Right? Now, what about on the German side? They look at this Versailles system, this set of constraints, the fact that Germany does not have the same political rights as the victor countries, even though she was now a democracy, right? And the only rationale for the unequal treatment of Germany, for not treating Germany the same as anyone else and not giving Germany the same rights, the only rationale was that, well, Germany deserved to be treated like that because she had caused the war. So the onus of having started the war is very much an integral part of this Versailles system, again, contributing to German resentment. But the key point to note here is that it's not the harshness of the Versailles peace that induces the Germans to revolt against it. And in fact, there is a revolt against the Versailles Treaty. It is not a phenomenon of the 1930s alone. It's the kind of leitmotif of this entire period. Germans referred to these constraints as the shackles of Versailles. Their goal was to smash the shackles of Versailles. And once they did that, Germany would reemerge as the number one power in Europe, stronger, relatively even, than she had been in 1914. But it's not simply resentment that leads the Germans to go that route. They wouldn't go that route if it had no chance of success. If a revolt led to to another war in which Germany would be crushed and in which the results would be even more unfavorable for the Germans than they had been after the First War. Right? What's a simple proof of this? You look at the settlement that was imposed on Germany after World War II, and you compare it with the Versailles settlement that was imposed on them after World War I. After World War II, Germany was divided. Lots of pre-war German territory had been lost to other countries, to Poland, and indeed to the Soviet Union itself a little bit. Half of pre-war Germany was under effective Soviet control, under the control of a hostile foreign power, including the whole area around the German capital of Berlin. Even Western Germany was not a fully independent country. Western Germany was not allowed to defend itself, basically, because you can't stand up to a great nuclear power like the USSR without nuclear weapons of your own. And West Germany wasn't allowed to develop a nuclear capability, forcing it into total dependence on the Western powers for protection. And this is not what a German nationalist would find particularly congenial. No, you don't find any of that after 1919. No foreign troops, outside the Rhineland. No foreign presence in Berlin. Why did the Germans accept the post-World War II settlement when they wouldn't accept the post-World War I settlement? It's like it's not. It's relative harshness. See, it's post-World War II. There's no chance of resisting. They even think in terms of war revenge against the Soviets, then they forfeit the protection of the Western allies, and that's it for them. Okay. So there's no chance of the Germans trying to rise up again and reclaim her position as the number one power in Europe. Right. Whereas 1919, a very different story. The power political conjuncture, the structure of power, is much more favorable to the Germans. So much so that once they kind of break through the kind of crust of the Versailles system, break the shackles of Versailles, these artificial constraints that were imposed on them, they would reclaim their power status. And it was not inconceivable that they would be able to do so. You know, basically, you wet your finger, you put it up to the wind, and you see how favorable the situation is for you. And they looked around, and what do they see? They look, they, you know, as I say, shielded from any Russian threat in the east. Not in fact, not even having to worry about Russia for a while, because Russia's in the throes of this revolution, pulling in on herself. Russia unlikely to make common cause with the West for ideological reasons. But just looking at the West, what do they see? They see America having withdrawn from Europe, British half withdrawing from Europe. And they see this weak France, bled white by the war, sensing deep down that she's dependent on her relations with the two other Western democracies for protection, and unwilling really to kind of go too far in terms of alienating them, held back from pursuing a really tough anti-German policy for fear of compromising her relations with the Anglo-Saxons. The path to resistance, might not be pleasant, might be rough at points, but there's the promise of success at the end of the road. It's not like this is a totally easy decision for the Germans, in part because French policy is not all that clear-cut. It's not as though the French have this policy of we want to crush the Germans, we want to kind of keep the Germans down no matter what. The French, terribly disillusioned by what they view as the betrayal of the part of Wilson and Lloyd George. They're kind of left to kind of fend for themselves. This whole notion of this was a common struggle, shouldn't we be in it to the end? Shouldn't we work together in terms of the post-war world? And now they see the Americans kind of going home, the British turning their backs on them. What's the reaction to that in France? It's to contemplate the notion of some sort of accommodation with Germany. You see this even during the peace conference itself, when the French are making these overtures, and in late 1919, and through the year 1920. And from the German point of view, some Germans feel maybe this is a way out. Not all Germans are nationalistic. Not all of them have been totally inflamed by this stuff. A lot of them feel like maybe we should try and work things out with the French. I mean, the kind of policy you see the Federal Republic of Germany pursuing after World War II is not without its antecedents in the post-World War I period. There were, you know, important people in Germany, in the German government, said that they did not want to reject the outstretched hand. But on balance, those forces lost out. And the Germans began to test how willing the Allies were to enforce the terms of the peace. And what do they do? Where are they going to resist it? Headlong revolt? No, that's not politically astute. You know, building up their army again, that will simply pull the Western powers together. They resist selectively. They resist most notably at the weakest point in the Versailles system, the reparations. This is why the reparations are so important in this whole period. The real issue here is whose power is going to dominate the continent of Europe? Is it going to be France or Germany? That question turns on whether the Versailles system, the Versailles constraints, are going to be maintained intact. And so the struggle in the post-World War I period that focused on the reparations was really a larger struggle over the Versailles system, and thus a larger struggle over over whether France or Germany would be the dominant power there. Okay. Why do they focus on the reparations? Well, other things, like I don't know, they are raising fortresses or not having an air force and so on. It's quite clear that it's not impossible for them to do these things, to refrain from building up a big army, right? If they go that route, it's clearly an act of policy, an act of will. However, with the reparations, it's somewhat different, because there's a real doubt about whether the Germans can pay substantial reparations. Without ruining their own economy, maybe ruining their own economy would be kind of a disaster. And the Germans, in fact, adopt this strategy. This is one of the big surprises of historical scholarship. Opting for an inflationary fiscal policy in Germany is very much to be understood in terms of the goal of throwing off the reparation settlement and throwing off, basically destroying Versailles. The great German inflation was deliberate in the sense of being targeted at the destruction of the Versailles system. Yeah? That's one of the reasons why kind of the more moderate types in Germany did not like the policy of resistance, because of the fear of what the implications would be domestically in terms of the German economy, the great inflation. Okay. The Germans would resist the reparation provisions because they know that they're going to get a lot of sympathy outside of Germany if they focus on the reparations, because a lot of people believe they can't pay. The key work here that laid out this argument was the enormously successful book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, by the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, in which he made the argument that Germans can't pay the reparation. Didn't matter how much of a surplus they were capable of generating domestically, surplus of real wealth. The problem was they couldn't get it across the borders, because to get it across the borders, they would have to earn foreign currencies by selling more in foreign markets than they bought, and that was just kind of impossible for them to do so. This was Keynes's argument. Okay. So the Germans resist. They don't deliver what they're supposed to be delivering, especially in terms of coal, for example. And so what are the French supposed to do, knowing that it's not simply a question of money, it's a question of what the political structure of Europe is going to be? Do you find the French rushing headlong to a policy of enforcement, of putting a knife to Germany's throat and insisting that she pay every last drop of what she owes? No. And again, this was quite surprising. You find the French as being much more moderate than that. The French Prime Minister in 1920, his name was Alexandre Milleron, he spoke in terms of economic collaboration between France and Germany. Their ambassador in Berlin was chosen because he symbolized the policy bringing the French and German economies together, and in that context, solving the whole reparation problem. The French also tried to work out a business-like plan. It's called the Seydoux Plan, late 1920, to kind of solve the transfer problem that Keynes said was so fundamental. Instead of saying that the Germans would have to pay in foreign currencies, which they could only earn by kind of flooding foreign markets with German exports, Seydoux said, no, you can pay in your own domestic currency. You can pay in paper marks, and we'll take these paper marks, and we'll put them in a fund, and we'll use that fund to kind of authorize contracts which the people who were kind of trying to rebuild their property in the devastated areas in northern France would place with German firms, so that you don't have to worry about the transfer problem. It's going to make all this stuff work easily. Over and over again, when you look at this stuff at the level of detail, you don't find the French, as pursuing a bellicose policy. If that works? Is that okay? Okay. I'll just leave it there. Okay. the Germans are tempted, and the point I was about to make was, you can understand French policy also in these geopolitical terms, in terms of French weakness, not strength. The fact that France is willing to contemplate some sort of accommodation with the Germans is a measure of France's sense of her own isolation and her own inability in the, over the long run to go it alone. But the Germans spurn these overtures, and in fact, throughout the year 1921, 1922, there's no solution that's worked out, and in fact, the French attitude hardens, and it culminates in the Ruhr occupation of 1923. This is the climax of this great test of strength between France and Germany over the reparations nominally, but really over the question of the Versailles system as a whole, and of the question of whose power is going to dominate Europe. What happens in the Ruhr? The French Prime Minister Poincaré goes into the Ruhr, which is the industrial heart of Germany, this whole area. The Ruhr is just off the right bank of the Rhine. It's the industrial heart of Germany. It's where their steel mills, their coal mines are located. Part of the German industrial economy. Basically, they go in because Germany had defaulted on the coal deliveries, and they issue these requisition orders for the coal to be sent to France. The Germans then ignore these orders and send that coal back into unoccupied Germany through a circuitous route, at which point the French then blockade the entire Ruhr. But the German government supports the workers in the Ruhr because they have been so patriotic and refusing to cooperate with the French. They finance the Ruhr passive resistance by simply printing up more and more money, because they're, on the one hand, their receipts, tax receipts, go down because of but the costs go up enormously. This leads to the great German hyperinflation of 1923. What happens is that these workers continue to work. The coal can't be shipped to France, and it can't be shipped to unoccupied Germany either. So it just piles up in these big mountains of coal near the pit heads. And so finally, by the summer of 23, Ruhr occupation began in January. In summer of 23, the French have solved the transport problem. Germany, hyperinflation is just ruining the German economy. It leads to all kinds of political troubles. The Nazi putsch in Munich and the communist uprisings in Saxony and Thuringia. And the Germans then, with a new government under Stresemann, they come to the French and basically say, what are your terms? And the French reaction? Silence. They don't tell the Germans what they want the Germans to do, because the French have, by this point, opted for this policy of maybe it wouldn't be so bad to see Germany just kind of disintegrate and sink deeper and deeper into chaos. But they're unwilling to push that policy to the bitter end and see mass starvation in Germany, communist revolution throughout Germany. And then finally, by December, when the British and the Americans offered to intervene and help both sides reestablish their economies and work out this whole thing, the French accept that offer. But it's contingent on France not doing anything like the Ruhr occupation again, not using force to compel Germany to comply with the terms of the treaty ever again. So you may say, France managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. And that in the final analysis, Germany won the great test of strength. But as you see, things are not quite that simple, and the whole situation that was established by this is a lot more complex than it would seem at first glance. So that's what I'll be talking about next time, the whole Locarno system.